Welcome to WisePod. Andalusia Farm, the home of Flannery O'Connor, is pleased to connect you with all manner of business happening here. As Flannery said, you can get to Milledgeville by bus and buzzard. And now, via WisePod. Enjoy.
Hello. Hello. Welcome. Good afternoon. Welcome to Andalusia. My name is Elizabeth Wiley. I'm the executive director here of the nonprofit that owns and manages the farm. Our talk today is by Dr. Rhonda Armstrong. She's the chair of the Department of English and Foreign Languages at Augusta University. Just was named to that last November, so congrats. She served as interim department chair since 2015 and has been with the university since 2009 when she joined the faculty as assistant professor of English. She has a doctorate in American Studies from St. Louis University, a Master of Arts in American Studies from St. Louis University, and a Bachelor of Arts in English from Western Kentucky. Dr. Armstrong has focused her work on Appalachian communities and rural culture. She's widely published, was a participant in the 2014 Reconsidering Flannery O'Connor, the NEH Institute here at Georgia College, organized by our very own Bruce Gentry. She's held numerous fellowships and presented peer-reviewed materials at national conferences. Today she'll speak on violent asceticism in the novel, drawing from her scholarship on corpses and lesser bodies. So please join me in welcoming Rhonda Armstrong.
Thank you. So yeah, when Elizabeth asked me what I was going to be doing, I said, well, you know, I work on corpses now. And then I got the little card and I realized, oh, that's maybe not the best advertising angle. So I'm really glad that you all came anyway. And it's not entirely about corpses. It's just, you know, from the point of view of someone who thinks about corpses all the time. And of course, O'Connor has lots of corpses. The bodies do pile up, but she also moves away from them pretty quickly. So we don't really see them very often. And The Violent Bared Away is one of the few times where, you know, we do have one that we sort of meditate on. And O'Connor told us not to pay too much attention to the bodies as they piled up in the ditches, because the bodies aren't really the point. And she dismissed a whole lot of the focus on the violence itself as readers missing the point. And regarding The Violent Bared Away, she wrote that she recognized that most readers wouldn't get what she was doing. In notes and letters discussing the title of the novel and the verse from Matthew from which it is taken, O'Connor specifies what she means by violence. And her idea of violence in this novel largely disregards those traditional types of violence, such as the murder, the arson, the rape. She takes her title from the Douay translation of Matthew 11:12, and from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent bear it away. In her letter to Betty Hester shortly following the novel's completion, O'Connor interprets this verse to mean that all prophets are necessarily violent because they resist nature. And she cites St. Thomas Aquinas, his interpretation of Matthew 11:12 as support. And in her interpretation of Matthew, O'Connor specifically reads the violence to be the violence of asceticism. Elsewhere in notes on the novel's title, she goes into more detail and she writes, this violence is not the violence of the Old Testament, but the violence of the New. It is the violence of love, which always goes beyond the written law and gives more than is demanded of it. It is the violence of a single-minded determination to conquer the self and win heaven. Both St. Augustine and St. Thomas say this verse refers to asceticism. Asceticism is an indication of this kind of love so violent that it does more than is demanded by law and gives everything to Christ. In a letter to Father J.J. Quinn, O'Connor elaborates on her idea of asceticism as it works in this verse and novel, saying that it's the passion that makes ascetics, the willingness, she says, to risk and spend oneself on faith. Now, earlier in that same letter, O'Connor claims that both Raber and Tarwater deny the force of prophecy within themselves for similar reasons. Tarwater, she says, wants to hear the Lord out of a clear and empty sky, she says in the novel, and that any human involvement, she says, is the lowering of one of himself. Of Raber, she says that he can't accept Christianity because he can't accept his child bishop. Christianity, she says, is repulsive because it means loving and sanctifying what is intellectually valueless. So only tar water overcomes that resistance by becoming violent in that ascetic sense in which O'Connor uses the term. He lowers himself until he can love violently, giving more than is demanded of him. The true violence of the novel, then, is not the arson, the murder, and the rape, or more accurately, it's not those violent acts in and of themselves, I think. It's the obliteration of Tarwater's selfish pride and his ultimate submission to his call to prophecy, to which those violent acts, of course, lead him. And this is a gradual acceptance, I think, spurred on in part by those acts of violence, but also what I would call the violence of care, that necessarily violent obliteration of his pride through the care for the least bodies, which here I look at as both a corpse, but also Bishop, who in this novel comes out as surprisingly corpse-like. So, I know. What O'Connor terms the Old Testament violence is certainly present in the novel. It remains important in that it advances Tarwater's progress toward rejecting his selfish pride. The initial violence of the novel, the burning of Powderhead, and Tarwater assumes Mason Tarwater's body along with it, is this emphatic rejection of his call to prophecy. In enacting this violence, Tarwater initially embraces that prideful nature, and O'Connor establishes his troublesome pride in the early scenes that flash back to his time with his great uncle. Mason Tarwater, too, had been initially prideful in his prophecy, and he had seen his pride burned away. And in the first pages of the novel, he describes this. I'm going to read this passage. He had been called in his early youth and had set out for the city to proclaim the destruction awaiting a world that had abandoned its savior. He proclaimed from the midst of his fury that the world would see the sun burst in blood and fire, and while he raged and waited, it rose every morning, calm and contained in itself, as if not only the world but the Lord himself had failed to hear the prophet's message. Then one morning he saw, to his joy, a finger of fire coming out of it, and before he could turn, before he could shout, the finger had touched him, and the destruction he had been waiting for had fallen in his own brain, in his own body. His own blood had been burned dry and not the blood of the world. Having learned much by his own mistakes, he was in a position to instruct Tarwater when the boy chose to listen in the hard facts of serving the Lord. The boy, who had ideas of his own, listened with an impatient conviction that he would not make any mistakes himself when the time came and the Lord called him. So repeatedly in those initial scenes, we see young Tarwater envisioning a prophetic calling that more closely resembles his uncle's initial attempts at prophecy, this very Old Testament prophecy. In that same passage, O'Connor tells us that Mason Tarwater's idea of prophecy changed when he kidnapped young Tarwater from Raber. In the beginning, she says, Mason's rage of vision had been clear in the kidnapping. He had known what he was saving the boy from, and it was saving and not destruction that he was seeking. He had learned enough to hate the destruction that had to come and not all that was going to be destroyed. Obviously, he doesn't, you know, fully turn. We still see those scenes. I'm slowly, though, coming around to Mason Tarwater. It's taken me a long time. But according to that passage, the kidnapping is sort of his turning point, after which God no longer needed to burn him with fire to correct his ways. He presumably starts to shift toward this prophecy of care. We don't see much of the prophecy of care in the depiction of Mason. He's dead, of course, from the opening lines of the novel, appears only in those flashbacks, many of which are from before the kidnapping. In those flashbacks, he's revealed to be prideful and quite often violent in the Old Testament sense. He shoots Raber twice when Raber comes to retrieve young Tarwater, and the boy's memories of him are full of his ravings and rages. On the other hand, there's also present the New Testament violence, I think, in the old man's wrestling with himself. Young Tarwater remembers him wandering off for days in the woods, returning, quote, bedraggled and hungry. He would look the way the boy thought a prophet ought to look. These were the times when Tarwater knew that when he was called, he would say, "Here I am, Lord, ready." At other times, there was no fire in his uncle's eye, and he spoke only of the sweat and stink of the cross, of being born again to die and of spending eternity eating the bread of life. And the boy would let his mind wander off to other subjects. Now, Most readers interpret these wanderings in the woods as Mason's grappling with a different kind of spirit, and perhaps it is. For whatever reason, though, he comes back reduced bodily in the same way that the prophets in the desert were reduced bodily. And he speaks in those other instances of this prophecy of care, an asceticism that is marked by lovingly attending to, or at least attending to, the basest aspects of life, the sweat and the stink and the dying. All of that is unappealing to young Tarwater's Old Testament sensibilities, and his vision of the ascetic prophet is not one who has a willingness to spend himself on faith, as O'Connor said in her letter to Father Quinn. At this point, Tarwater desires only that fire from on high, not the lowering of himself to care for the messiness of the human body. Young Tarwater's desire for the fire is evident in how he responds to those tasks with which his great uncle charges him, the burial of Mason's body and the baptism of Bishop. Both of these acts require Tarwater to take on the care of the least bodies, and his pride rejects that call to humble himself in such care. When Mason charges Tarwater with completing his failed mission to baptize Bishop, Tarwater rejects it outright, saying he doubts very much that his first mission would be to baptize a dim-witted child. "Oh no, it won't be," he said. "He don't mean for me to finish up your leavings. He has other things in mind for me." And he thought of Moses, who struck water from a rock, of Joshua, who made the sun stand still, Daniel, who stared down the lions in the pit. Thinking instead of these very flashy Old Testament prophets, Tarwater denies any kind of call to a prophecy that requires him to reject his own pride, obliterate his own pride. Baptizing this child is beneath him, and he is incapable of reducing himself sufficiently to care for bodies on that level. Mason's other charge, though, also requires him to care for the least body. First the dead, then the disabled, and both of these he sees as beneath his stature as a called prophet of God. Although he reluctantly accepts the charge to bury Mason Tarwater's body, which I think is interesting in and of itself. Even in that acceptance, though, he resists the call to really minister to the lesser body. He takes it on as an act of closure, one definitive act that will end this old man's prophecy and begin his own. And repeatedly, as he goes about this act of digging the grave, Tarwater grumbles that his great uncle will have to, quote, take what he gets. The dead are poor. You can't be any poorer than dead. And Tarwater repeats this last one again. In this running commentary between himself and the stranger, Tarwater moves to reject the corpse, differentiating between himself and the dead man, finally coming to the belief that you don't owe the dead anything. To this declaration, the voice of the stranger responds, nor they you. And that's the way it ought to be in this world. Nobody owing nobody nothing. Tarwater, here, succeeds in reducing the old man's corpse to an object. He digs the grave under the fig tree because it will be good for the figs. This is, in some ways, more sacrilegious than the attempted cremation. The cremation is expedient, which diminishes the obligation of the living toward the dead. But it also acknowledges that obligation in its breach of it. He's doing it on purpose because he recognizes that he has an obligation to do otherwise. Planting him under the fig tree reduces Mason Tarwater to fertilizer, the appropriateness of which has been debated for 2.5 millennia, whether or not it is okay to use bodies in practical ways. We're sort of shifting back now that we have like the eco pods where you can get your ashes formed into a little pot for a tree, or the jewelry. You can make some flashy bling. Yeah. We're sort of shifting back, and we can decide whether or not that's the fall of civilization or not. But certainly, the church has tended to come down on the side that that's not okay. As Tarwater says, though, he's going to have to take what he gets. And if his body is just to be used the same way we would use a load of dung, well, then you don't owe the dead anything. Yet, the repetition here and at the end of "you can't be any poorer than dead" reestablishes this connection between the living Tarwater and the dead one. And this link is what Tarwater tries violently to sever. infatuated with these superhuman, supernatural prophets, Tarwater wants nothing to do with these stinking, sweating bodies of nature. But you can't be any poorer than dead kind of uncomfortably blurs this distinction between the you who owes nothing and the you who can't be any poorer than dead and may not be owed anything but requires quite a lot. The corpse, we think of, as Yulia Kristeva says, seen without God and outside of science, which is important, is the utmost of objection. It's identifiably human, and yet it's necessarily inhuman. It's an object, and yet it's a person. In this sense, you can't be any poorer than dead, as Tarwater says, but the dead is still recognizably connected to you. And it's this recognition that he moves to reject. If it's true that you don't owe the dead anything, then perhaps he can escape identification with this utmost of abject bodies. Perhaps he can be the prophet who hears the voice on high rather than the prophet who must minister to the lowest human body. But in this rejection, Tarwater ignores his great uncle's exhortations that the dead are in fact the point of living. The world was made for the dead. Think of all the dead there are, old Tarwater told him. There's a million times more dead than living, and the dead are dead a million times longer than the living are alive. When the stranger suggests at one point, it ain't the day of judgment for him you're worried about, it's the day of judgment for you, he's not far off the mark. The necessity of caring for the dead comes, at least in part, from their connection to humanity, and from the knowledge that whatever happens to the dead will inescapably one day happen to all of us. The dead are the most helpless bodies, straddling that boundary between human and object. And Tarwater, being called upon to minister to this most abject object body, is asked to reveal his ability to minister to all low bodies. And of course, he fails, initially. Ironically, in many ways, I think that it's actually Raeburn who sets himself to this task of ministering to the least body, although he himself would likely deny its significance. Mason Tarwater had tried to make Raeburn into the prophet, teaching him to follow in his path, but his instruction failed, and Raeburn had chosen to live his life according to pure scientific principles, denying the very existence of God. Mason's wandering in the woods, after which he seemed to Tarwater to be a real prophet, are precipitating, in fact, by the thought that he might have helped the nephew on his new course, a realization that O'Connor likens to a pit, she says, which opens up before his feet. Undoubtedly, in these realizations, Mason's thinking of Raeburn's rejection of God and his refusal to baptize Bishop, his mockery of the call to prophecy. However, Raeburn retains one possible route to redemption. He has still, despite all his attention to reason and science, this hint of his uncle's madness, which in this case manifests itself in this uncontrollable love for the world that he channels entirely into Bishop. In this uncontrollable love, then, he maintains some part of Mason's teaching, which remained manifest in this care for his disabled son, the physical care of his disabled son, because it really is only physical. Tarwater recognizes the seed and says, it fell in you, not in me. And they argue about who it actually fell in more, who's aware that it fell in them, and who knows how to weed it out and all that. Raeburn, though, keeps control of this compulsion to minister by directing it all into Bishop. And as he sort of relinquishes this care over the course of the novel, he severs that last remaining connection and destroys his own humanity in the process, turning into the machine, a little box in his head. But as he relinquishes this care, I think he relinquishes it to Tarwater, mostly, setting his nephew on that path to prophecy himself. So Raeburn, like Tarwater, argues that baptizing Bishop is meaningless because in both their minds, the facts of his body reduce him to something less than fully human. Just as Tarwater believes that the act of baptizing Bishop is beneath his dignity, Raeburn argues on at least two occasions that baptizing him would be pointless because Bishop would never know the difference. There is no human dignity in it. To Mason, he says, you could slosh water on him for the rest of his life and he'd still be an idiot. 5 years old for all eternity, useless forever as a matter of principle, as a gesture of human dignity. he'll never be baptized. I'm sort of skipping some words there. Later, he explains to Tarwater that the act itself is meaningless, but as a gesture of human dignity, he will not be baptized, he says. In place of that empty act, then, Raber, perhaps in spite of himself, pursues the way you accomplish yourself, as he calls it. The man of science gives in to unreason in the case of Bishop, into whom he channels the uncontrollable love for the world, a love that is clearly tied to this life of prophecy for which Mason Tarwater tried to prepare him. Raber recognizes the irrationality of this love, and he describes it, or O'Connor describes it, as with little or no warning, he would feel himself overwhelmed by the horrifying love. If, without thinking, he lent himself to it, he would feel suddenly a morbid surge of the love that terrified him, powerful enough to throw him to the ground in an act of idiot praise. It was completely irrational and abnormal. Love without reason, love for something futureless, love that appeared to exist only to be itself imperious and all-demanding, the kind that would cause him to make a fool of himself in an instant. And he only began with Bishop. Here, Raber's struggle echoes those parts of Tarwater's internal dialogue and also O'Connor's exact description of what she sees as the violence of asceticism. He, too, is faced with a futureless body. He claims repeatedly that Bishop is futureless, useless, a mistake of nature, the type of human that, quote, in 100 years, people may have learned enough to put to sleep when they're born. So he, too, is asked to enact this love that has no purpose other than itself, that does, as O'Connor wrote, more than is demanded, just as Tarwater is expected to care for this corpse that will serve him no purpose other than potentially benefiting the figs. And yet, when faced with this, quote, futureless body, Raber responds in what I think is a kind of interesting way. O'Connor, and many of the critics who read this novel, would suggest that Raber rejects the call for prophecy, that he rejects his son. But as Shanna Skelton argues in her recent article in the Flannery O'Connor Review, his rejection is not quite as clear-cut as it might seem. Whereas young Tarwater accepts the call to prophecy but rejects the method, Raber does kind of the opposite. He rejects the call, but he takes on the method. Skelton points out that Raber seeks to, quote, bring about justice and good, desires which are marks of a Christian and also perhaps at least the marks of a proclaiming secular humanist who does not yet recognize his own identity as a man made in the image of God. Raber is the one who adopts the ascetic discipline, as she and others point out, denying himself pleasure, and she mentions specifically the little iron bed and the hard chair, but I think it goes beyond that, beyond the rejection of bodily pleasure. I think that his self-effacement also includes his care for this so-called futureless child. That is, his asceticism is more than a mortification of the body and will, a body and will, in the sense of reducing bodily comfort and desire. It's also mortification in the sense of acknowledging one's own kinship with those least bodies, those ones with no future. Like corpses, or actually corpses, you're obliged to care for, even though you'll get nothing in return. Although it is sometimes accompanied by rushes of emotion, Raber's physical care for his son is ascetic in its own way. As O'Connor described it, it's the indication of this kind of love, so violent that it does more than is demanded by law and gives everything to Christ. She says in the very next paragraph that this is a dedication Raber has thrown off. But if he does throw it off, he doesn't do so until the very end. And I think that he maybe doesn't throw it off so much as he gradually hands it over to his nephew. When Tarwater comes to live with Raber, Raber sees this chance, and many readers point this out, to raise this son the way that he would have wanted to. He plans to educate Tarwater in the way that Bishop cannot be educated, and we do see the shift in his attention from his son to his nephew. But I think the other significant shift is the responsibility of Bishop shifting from Raber to Tarwater. When Mason first confronts Raber about Bishop, he derides the schoolteacher's self-declared rational side, arguing you can't change a child's pants in your head. This is true. And Raber seems to acknowledge that his rational approach of educating his son and bringing him up according to his theories are useless in Bishop's case. We learn that Raber has sent him off to a special school where he's learned to dress himself and feed himself, thereby relieving Raber at least a little bit of the responsibility of changing the child's pants. But as we see in O'Connor's descriptions of Raber and Bishop's interactions, Raber still performs significant acts of care for the child, often unthinkingly. And in the one scene where Bishop goes and jumps in the fountain, she says, he suffered Bishop to climb onto his lap. The child's shoelaces were untied and he tied them. When he finished tying the shoes, he continued to hold the child, sprawled and grinning in his lap. And of course, that's juxtaposed then later in the same scene, just a moment later, with Tarwater's, we realize later, compulsion to baptize the child so that those two things are contrasted. Later, he pulls Bishop out of the fountain, takes off his wet shoes, insists on going home to get dry shoes for him. We see, of course, in the description of Bishop with his mismatched, ill-fitting, not always clean clothes, the weird little hat, Raber may not do a particularly good or careful job of keeping him clothed and shod, but he does make sure that it's done. He takes on at least some level of care for this child. And while he says once or twice that his wife abandoned him, O'Connor says elsewhere that he got rid of his wife, after which he and the child began to live together in quiet, automatic fashion, implying that Raber is, at least partly by his own choice and will, Bishop's sole caretaker. Only he attends to this child's basic needs. Bishop, of course, requires all of this tending. He's utterly dependent on his father for survival. Both Raber and Tarwater comment on this, his similarity to old Tarwater, physically and otherwise. And I think that in terms of his soul-saving capacity, Bishop functions sort of similarly to the old man. Raber and, to a lesser extent, Tarwater describe him in terms, again, that suggest he's only barely human, the mistake of nature, accident, futureless. As Raber describes him, he might as well be dead. And yet, here he is, evidencing little thought or personality, or at least little that any of these other characters are willing to acknowledge, but demanding quite a lot of attention and care. When Tarwater first comes to the city, Raber recognizes that the young man is repelled by Bishop, and he understands why. He knows that the reason is that this child reminds him so much of the old man. And when Raber thinks of this link between Bishop and Mason Tarwater, it's the living, demanding old man that he sees. But I think that young Tarwater is reminded just as much of the dead old man, similarly futureless and barely human, but demanding much attention and care. Now, young Tarwater, I think, makes this connection kind of obliquely when the three of them eat dinner. In describing Bishop, he says, he's like a hog. He eats like a hog, and he don't think no more than a hog, and when he dies, he'll rot like a hog. Me and you too, he said, looking back at the schoolteacher's mottled face, we'll rot like hogs. The only difference between me and you and a hog is me and you can calculate. But there ain't any difference between him and one. Okay, so all of them then will eventually die and rot. All of them will be like hogs. But that fate is for Raber and Tarwater in the future. For Bishop, Tarwater suggests, it makes little difference. He'll be like a hog when he's dead, and he's like a hog now. Tarwater seems to believe that this absolves him of any responsibility toward Bishop. Just as if you don't owe the dead anything, why should he have any obligations to this child who's like a hog? Who's futureless. So he avoids Bishop and finds himself completely justified in doing so, but Bishop doesn't stop demanding his attention. And finally, when they get to this lodge, the child forces Tarwater into this decision. He plops down on the stair in front of him, and the scene goes. The child began to scramble up the steps on his hands and knees, kicking his feet up on each one. Suddenly, he flipped himself around and sat squarely in the country boy's way and stuck his feet out in front of him, apparently wanting his shoes tied. The country boy stopped still. He hung over him like someone bewitched, his long arms bent uncertainly. The woman watched fascinated. He ain't gonna tie them, she said. Not him. He leaned over and began to tie them. Frowning furiously, he tied one and then the other, and the child watched, completely absorbed in the operation. It goes on. Until this point, Tarwater had barely interacted with Bishop, touching him really only to slap his hand away. But here, he reduces himself to serve the child, whose humanity he's heretofore not acknowledge, kneeling at his feet to tie his shoes. Bishop starts to spend more time in Tarwater's company to the point that Raver starts to feel sort of jealous and is like, I'm going to go back to the city by myself if I have to. But of course he doesn't get the chance, because once Tarwater takes on that first act of bodily care, he can no longer ignore Bishop's humanity. Everything is spiraling. If Bishop is human, then perhaps Tarwater does owe him something, and perhaps he's meant to be a prophet who ministers to these least bodies, not the grandiose prophet of the self, but the prophet of the violently selfless asceticism. In his last violent attempt to throw off his uncle's call, violent in the Old Testament sense, he accidentally baptizes the child in acknowledgement, in spite of himself, of Bishop's worth. Christina Bieber Lake writes about the importance of the baptism here as a physical act, dramatized so that it cannot be to the reader merely symbolic. It is, she writes, quote, a literal acting out of the Christian's being buried with Christ in baptism so that he can be raised again. And she notes that as Bishop enters a literal death, Tarwater follows him in a symbolic one. In the following section, then, as Tarwater rides back to Powderhead, he relives this drowning and baptism. It's the most detailed description that we get. Throughout this description, as Tarwater's consciousness shifts back and forth between the lake and the cab of the truck, we see all these images that conflate the child's death with his own potential death. Quotes like, the boy felt himself sinking backwards into the water as if the whole bank were pulling him down. His muscles began to jerk, his arms flailed. His mouth opened to make way for cries that would not come. He grappled with the air, as if he had been flung like a fish on the shores of the dead, without lungs to breathe there, and so on, until he speaks the words of baptism. Then finally, he's picked up by the man in the lavender and cream-colored car, who drugs him, rapes him, leaves him naked, corpse-like, in the woods, a scene that is sort of his complete reduction of self. Brought then to this death-like, abject state, he awakens as someone not quite himself, and we get the description of his face being contorted and slowly re-emerging back into a recognizable safe face. His self then completely reduced, Tarwater is ready to care for those to whom he owes nothing. He heads off as quickly as he can to Powderhead and the corpse of his uncle, where he prostrates himself on the grave, smears the dirt on his forehead, and at the novel's end, he is trekking toward the city, where he will warn the children of God of the terrible speed of mercy. Significantly, I think, but I won't go into this, retracing the footsteps of Buford Munson, who is the one who actually began the burial that Tarwater had rejected. O'Connor describes his mission as purgatorial, which I'm still thinking about, because it's a state in which the body is dead, but the soul may or may not still bear some link to it. The medieval church held that Christians had special obligations to souls in purgatory, that our responsibility to the dead was kind of reasonably heightened the more newly dead they were. The dead in purgatory need the living. Their pain can be eased by any number of actions of the living, including appropriate burial. And that burial may help if it's close to other dead bodies that are in a position to intercede for them. So purgatory, and also the function of relics, those special dead bodies, blurs this distinction here between the body and the soul. And this is the state where we leave Tarwater at the end. He is both part of this world and not. He's been burned clean, as O'Connor says. He's scorched and reduced bodily to this corpse-like state. And so, reduced, he heads off to the city, ready to minister to the souls and bodies alike in whatever form he may find them. And that's where I leave. I'm still sort of working on the purgatory. Apparently, I have to read a lot more about purgatory and what the church says about purgatory. But thank you.
We'll take a few questions here and then retire to the dining room. If folks can feel free to wander around the property and enjoy. Thank you again, Rhonda.
No, I'll start. I have lots of questions for Rhonda, but I will start by asking, how do these corpses fit into kind of the larger constellation of corpses you've looked at? Are they, you know, how do they compare?
Good question. Yeah, so O'Connor's corpses don't fit neatly.
Yeah.
And part of it is, as I said, she so often doesn't show us the corpses. Like, we know that they're there, but, you know, deaths happen off scene. We never actually encounter them, or if we do, we look away very quickly. So I'm working on this whole project on corpses, especially with Southern writers, and O'Connor just kind of doesn't fit, and I tried to avoid, as you know, really writing about O'Connor. You know, I said, well, it's just not the same thing, right? Like, they don't really work. I probably can't fit them in. And when I was at the NEH Institute, you know, I would sit down and talk with the visiting scholars, and they would say, yeah, you have to kind of include O'Connor. And I would say, great, how do you think that might work? And I go, I have no idea. But you have to write about it. And so one is the fact that it's very much more Catholic, right? And so, but it makes such a difference that we have this very religious approach to the meaning of these corpses. You know, they don't stand as nice, neat little symbols as they so often do. You can't sort of neatly put them into a little box and say, oh, look, this is how the corpse is working here, because there's always this sort of complication to it. And this weirdness. I mean, you know, with Mason Tarwater, like the burial, and, you know, then you have to go back and what does burial mean, and what did it mean in the church, and what did it mean with the Greeks and everyone else. You know, burial comes from God. Genesis doesn't tell us a whole lot about burial, but if you go back to the rabbinical literature, we get the story of Cain and Abel, and after Abel was killed, Adam and Eve especially mourns, but they have this body and this unprecedented corpse, and so what are you going to do with this corpse? And Abel lies unburied for a while with his dog guarding him to keep the beasts away, and then God sends a bird who dies. And another bird comes and digs a little hole, pushes him in and covers him up, and Adam says, oh, what a great idea, this is what I shall do. And then what do you do with that? Because supposedly burial is the thing that separates us from the animals, and yet it's the animals who would, of course, have more experience with corpses at that point in very short history. But what does that mean? It just, you know, O'Connor just sort of spirals out into areas that other writers don't. Which is not a very good answer to your question.
No, but yeah. Well, that's why I asked, because it isn't like Abby Bundren has this symbolic thing, or, yeah.
Right, yeah. And you can very just look at how the characters interact with it. Yeah, yeah, it doesn't work that way. Not in O'Connor. Shall we? You want to move into the...
Yeah. Let's wander into the other room, but meanwhile, I just wanted to thank you, Lana, and also thank the support of the Flannery O'Connor Review and the Wyoming Arts Council, which participated in bringing the artists here for this exhibit. So feel free to enjoy all of that, and we'll retire to the dining room where we can ask Lana more questions. Thank you.
Thank you.